Hey everyone, and welcome back to Captain Hunter's Podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in. I truly appreciate your time, your effort, and your energy. Thank you so much. The podcast is truly growing, and I truly appreciate it. We got a dynamic episode for you today. If you have not heard of Sergeant Cheryl Dorsey, well, now you have. She's a dynamic speaker. She's been on CNN. She's been on Fox News, MSNBC. She is a nationally and internationally known police advocate advocating for police reform. Before we get into that, I want to just encourage you guys to go over to the Patreon page. Make sure that you are subscribing. That way you can get these show notes. Also, I want to encourage you guys, if you don't want to go over to the Patreon page, the podcast can be supported through Cash App, Venmo, PayPal, Captain L Hunter, that's CPT L Hunter for PayPal, Venmo, and Cash App. I also want you to subscribe to the episodes, whether you're listening on Google, Spotify, Spreaker, Stitcher, Breaker, TuneIn, whatever you're listening to this podcast on, please make sure that you hit that subscribe button, rate, and share. Hit that subscribe button, rate, and share. My guest is Sergeant Cheryl Dorsey. She hosts her own podcast. Her podcast is called Sergeant Dorsey Speaks. Sergeant Dorsey Speaks. She also has a YouTube channel, Sergeant Dorsey Speaks. Now, just for giggles, I Googled top police podcasts, and I was very shocked and surprised. Now, I wasn't surprised that my podcast is not up there. I mean, mine is fairly new, but I was surprised that her podcast, Sergeant Dorsey Speaks podcast, is not one of the top police podcasts. Now, we need to fix that. So how do we fix that? We need to subscribe, we need to rate, and we need to share. So please go over to her podcast. Make sure you subscribe to her podcast. She gives out great information and keeps you up to date on what's going on in the police world. So please make sure you subscribe to my podcast, her podcast, rate my podcast. Make sure you rate her podcast high as well. And make sure you share it. Share through email, through Twitter, through Facebook. Just continue to share and get this information out there. We need more people who are outspoken about what's going on in the police world. And listen, none of us is anti-police. Neither one of us are former police officers who want to now just bash the police. That's not our intention, but we do want to make the police better. We believe in police reform. We believe that any bad apples should be taken out of the bunch and that the police officers can do their job efficiently and effectively and without bias and without racism, without hatred, without excessive use of force and all that kind of stuff. So just make sure you go over, check out her podcast, make sure you rate, subscribe, and all that kind of stuff. Once again, it's Sergeant Dorsey Speaks, and subscribe to her YouTube channel as well, Sergeant Dorsey Speaks. That's SGT.Dorsey, D-O-R-S-E-Y Speaks. So make sure you check all that out. Let me just give you a little bit about Sergeant Dorsey's bio. In 1980, Cheryl joined the Los Angeles Police Department. During her 20-year LAPD career, she worked exclusively in patrol and specialized units in all four geographic bureaus within the city of LA, South, Central, West, and the Valley. In addition to various patrol assignments, Sergeant Dorsey was assigned to the Traffic Division, Newton Area Vice, and the infamous gang unit in Operations South Bureau known as Community Resources Against Street Hoodlums, the Crash Unit. As a 20-year veteran of the LAPD and a mother of four sons, Sergeant Dorsey understands that no one is immune from being racially profiled, harassed, or becoming the victim of police abuse under the color of authority. As a police expert with an eye towards social justice advocacy, she provides a candid, honest, and unique perspective on social and institutional abuses with a level of credibility that is effective, relevant, and irrefutable. As an LAPD insider, Sergeant Dorsey highlights criminal, social, or public policy injustices affecting disenfranchised communities throughout the nation. As a mother and police professional, Sergeant Dorsey exposes social and institutional disparities and abuses while introducing strategies and commentary on how to systematically attack those injustices, empower audiences with a broad and unique perspective on how to navigate within that system when necessary and help change that system when possible. Cheryl Dorsey also has a book out, so she wrote an original book called Black and Blue, The Creation of a Manifesto. She then updated that book last year, and it's now entitled Black and Blue, The Creation of a Social Justice Advocate. It's called Volume 2, but it's just incorporated the first book that I mentioned, Creation of a Manifesto, and she updated it with the different controversial police shootings that have gone across the nation, Terrence Crutcher, Tamir Rice, and a number of others. So please make sure you check out her book, Black and Blue, The Creation of a Social Advocate. That's by Cheryl Dorsey. Head on over to Amazon and make sure you check that out. So without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, here is Sergeant Cheryl Dorsey. Please enjoy the interview. Thank you so much, Sergeant Cheryl Dorsey, for coming on Captain Hunter's podcast. Thank you so much. I truly appreciate it. As I said, I'm a big fan. Thank you for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Just tell us a little bit about yourself, how you got into this. Just tell us a little bit about what you got going on.
So I'm a retired LAPD sergeant, 20 years. Spent all 20 years in uniform, proud to say. And I've worked pretty much everywhere within the city of Los Angeles, which is divided into four geographical bureaus. I worked all four, Central, South, West, and Valley. And having worked all four bureaus, I often talk about, and you understand this, you know, how most police departments have, you know, two departments within one, right? You have the police department in the hood, if you will, for us, the south of the Santa Monica Freeway. And then you have the LAPD north of the Santa Monica Freeway. And it's always, you know, interesting how officers figure out how to comport themselves very differently when they're in the more affluent neighborhoods, right?
Right.
So I just use my experiences, my lived experiences as a Black woman, as a police supervisor, and talk about the things that we're seeing happening real time, day to day, and why in some instances I think officers are being a little overzealous, a little extra aggressive, if you will, a little unnecessary in the use of force, physical force, and then sometimes deadly force. I speak about these issues based on my own professional and personal experiences, and then I try to offer solutions and suggestions on how I think we all might better navigate through those police encounters, because at the end of the day, the goal is for everybody to go home safe. And so to that end, I wrote an autobiography, Black and Blue, The Creation of a Social Advocate. And I'll talk a little bit more about where you can find it. But that's kind of how this whole thing got started. All right, let me just back up a little bit and say this, because my first book was Black and Blue, The Creation of a Manifesto. And I wrote Black and Blue, The Creation of a Manifesto, because of a situation here in L.A. with Christopher Dorner, Black LAPD officer who got fired, had issues with the department, and went on a killing spree. And so I wanted people to understand how not only the police department, but any employer can push you to the brink and have you do something that's really out of your character, that's untoward. I didn't want anyone else, after understanding how Christopher Dorner got there, find themselves similarly situated and act out in the same way. And so Creation of a Manifesto was my life story, not Christopher Dorner's, but my life story, the trials and tribulations that I went through, how I dealt with them, and showing that I am proof that there's life after whatever agency, whatever corporation you may work for, and you get shown the door. So I wanted people to understand what that looked like, and that was in 2013. 2014, Eric Garner was killed, Mike Brown, here in Los Angeles, Ezell Ford. And I was watching family members not have the words to say about what they felt and what they wanted done in the aftermath of their loved one being killed. And so I realized that, I have something to say about this based on my lived experiences. And let me give them the words. Let me speak publicly. Let them hear me so they would know what to ask of their police chief, of their police department, to do differently down the road. And that's how I became this spokesperson, advocate, critic sometimes of police policy.
Now, I'm actually reading Black and Blue, The Creation of a Social Advocate right now. That's volume two. And I think your story is very interesting as far as how you came on. So you came on after a consent decree was imposed upon the city of Los Angeles. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Right. So in 1980, I was working for Department of Justice, and I was in a stenographer pool working, doing reports, if you will, clerical work for special agents in the Bureau of Narcotic Enforcement, Bureau of Investigation. And because back then PCP was prevalent and a big deal, they used me as part of a sting operation because they wanted to arrest a young Black guy who was dealing PCP. And so they had me participate in the sting operation, and I showed up at a restaurant. He met me under a guise of, I have a, you know, need a place to stay. I'm new in town. And they took him into custody. And I was like, what? This is what you guys do? And I know what I was making as a stenographer. I knew what they were making as special agents. So I was like, I need to do what you do. So LAPD was hiring, as were other departments, but LAPD had a consent decree. So I was applying all over town, but because of the consent decree, they had a hurried and expedited hiring process. And they put me through, gave me an academy date. And then once I joined LAPD, the premise was do a year, get off probation, get my post certificate, police officer standard and training certificate, lateral back to DOJ as a special agent. But when I joined LAPD, what I found out was they have an amazing benefit package, and I can do this job for 20 years. I was very, very young. care and have a pension for the rest of my life. So I decided I'm just going to hunker down here on the LAPD, do these 20 years, get my lifetime pension, and then figure out what I want to do with the rest of my life. And that's just kind of how it happened.
Okay, nice. When I got promoted to sergeant, it was the first time in history, and I got promoted in the year 2000. So for the first time, City of Waterbury's history, there were four black officers who came out on the top 20 for the listing, for the testing process, and three of us were in the top 10. And there was talk amongst other people about, we would call the Guardians, black officers were a member of the group called the Guardians. I don't know if LAPD has anything like that, and just a black organization for black officers. People outside of the organization were asking, you know, are the Guardians all studying together? What are they doing? Are they getting extra points for being black and all that kind of stuff? Did you feel any type of heat from any other officers outside your organizations because you were hired under this consent decree? Or did you feel any type of way or hear any kind of backlash because more black officers were being hired and or more female officers were being hired?
Well, no, I didn't have any issue because my academy class was very unique in that we were evenly split. And this was the first time that had happened. And it was such kind of an anomaly, if you will, that more seasoned officers, training officers, would often come up to the police academy just to look at us like we were some kind of specimen. We were a thing they had never seen before.
Exactly.
It was 20 women and 20 guys. So because there were so many females, I mean, that made it very unique and very different. But we didn't get any backlash per se because there were so many women. And even though there were 20 women in my class, I was one of two blacks. So while they were encouraged, the department was encouraged and under this consent decree, I mean, it wasn't like they hired 20 blacks. I mean, over time, you know, they increased the number of blacks on LAPD and now it's predominantly Hispanic. You know, they did what they had to do because they were forced to. And then once the consent decree ended, then so did the recruitment wholesale of black folks, right?
Mm.
And I think, to be honest with you, the guys, although they may not have really thought women had a place on the department in terms of doing the job, they certainly did appreciate having females on the job for extracurricular other kind of stuff.
I got you. One of your mantras on your podcast is that you talk about pulling the covers back and explaining code talk and things like that. You're very outspoken about police procedures and just bringing a layman's understanding to the public. Do you receive any pushback from that? Any negative emails, death threats, things like that?
Oh, I get lots of people coming for me on social media. You know, the internet gangsters, right? Because they have the anonymity, an avatar that looks like a bowl of fruit or some name like Tony the Tiger. You know, I don't know who the heck it is.
Right.
And I don't necessarily know, to be honest with you, a lot of times I feel like it's not anybody that looks like me that is most bothered by what I say, because black folks understand and they appreciate me speaking honestly and truthfully about the things that, you know, they've been complaining about all along, and everybody would foo-foo them away or try to minimize and mitigate what it was they were saying. And now you have a black woman who wore the uniform, wore it for 20 years, did it all in patrol. And one thing you can't do, you may not agree with what I say or you may not like what I say, but you can't say I'm being dishonest. You
right.
can't say that I'm not being truthful. And so, yeah, I get a lot of people that come after me anonymously in terms of my peers and my colleagues. Again, folks who look like me, you know, you understand, on any job, it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. And I'm talking about when that employer reminds you, oh, by the way, you do know you're black.
Yeah.
So I just speak about the things that most people won't say out loud, because if I truly am interested in bringing about change, and that's my goal, change from within, change with regards to what police officers do, police supervisors, police chiefs do, and if I'm interested in bringing about change in terms of preserving life and making sure that the community understands they have a role to play in this as well, then we need to be honest. We need to have a real dialogue about what's wrong so we can fix it.
Right. You and I are part of an organization called LEAP, an article that you wrote for Ozzy about menthol cigarettes in the black community. And I know that LEAP organization is doing a presentation about menthol cigarettes. Do you like to speak a little bit about that and how that affects the black community in particular?
Well, you know, I wrote that article not really with Leap in mind, and it's just kind of interesting how that morphed into, you know, what it became ultimately. They found my article and started using it because we were kind of speaking the same lingo, if you will. But, you know, my concern with criminalizing the use of menthol tobacco is, number one, be clear, I'm not an advocate for anyone who smokes. I think you should have your own choice. If you, you know, choose to smoke, use menthol or non-menthol tobacco products, that's your choice. I just have a problem with criminalizing it, because if you really want to make a difference, then let's educate the community on the ills, if you will, associated with the use of tobacco. And the fact that this is something specific to menthol products, when we understand that menthol tobacco products like Newport cigarettes, Kool cigarettes, Benson and Hedges, Salem, blacks and browns primarily, predominantly, are the users of those products. And so I'm concerned about pretext police stops, giving officers another tool in which to engage our community. Can you imagine the outrage, the disbelief that would be associated with a millennial being stopped by a police officer because they smell menthol tobacco on them and they say that this is legitimate probable cause?
Right.
We have enough issues with our young people, you know, being bothered by being racially profiled in their mind, whether it's real or not, because of the color of their skin while they're driving, while they're walking, and now almost while we do anything, right? The whole hashtag living while black.
So,
police are encountering us for all kinds of reasons. So we're going to add menthol to the mix?
Right.
I have a problem.
Yeah, and I agree with you on that problem. So many states and communities are going away from probable cause as far as the smell of marijuana. And so now some states want to add menthol to this. So this is, seems to be going backwards. There's one step forward and two steps backwards in many cases.
Right, and I mean, and listen, in some places, you know, you can smoke a joint, but you can't have a Newport cigarette. What?
Yeah.
It makes no sense.
Yeah. So speaking of change, what are your feelings about AB 392, the change of the use of force from reasonable to necessary? How do you feel about that?
So I was involved in some of the discussions and I had an opportunity to speak here in the state capitol with regards to AB 392. I'm a supporter of it. I don't think it's enough, but, you know, we needed to do something. We needed to start somewhere. And so this is a great stepping stone. My position has been this all along, is that any good police officer can articulate reasonable and they can articulate necessary. And so it's very difficult to argue what is in the mind of a police officer when they use deadly force. One of the benefits, I believe, with AB 392 is that now it's going to have an officer speak to the tactics prior to the shooting, whereas before it was just the moment that a round was fired. I've always said that poor tactics lead to bad shootings. If an officer creates a situation, manufactures, you know, probable cause to detain a person, gets aggressive with someone, and they created that opportunity to use deadly force, then that's a problem, and they're going to have to speak to it. What needs to happen now going forward is that there needs to be accountability, personal, financial accountability when an officer violates department policy and or law and takes a life. Don't just shoulder the burden of the civil settlement on taxpayers. Have that officer have to pay just 1%. That'll break an officer's back. You know what I mean. We all live paycheck to paycheck like everybody else. 1.1% of 6.4 million, 5.2, 1.3, they'll stop this stuff yesterday.
I read somewhere fairly recently where a city did do that, where they made the officer personally pay $25,000 and the city paid, it was like 1.2 million or something like that. So I think that that may be a trend that we may be seeing fairly soon.
I think if that, you know, if officers, you know, had to think about, you know, they could come after me financially, they won't be so quick to pull the trigger and just say, I was afraid, he scared me, he didn't turn around, they didn't comply, she wouldn't put out a cigarette. They would think twice about why they actually used deadly force. And and I'm sure, you know, it's not unique to LAPD, but this is what I know, is that you have to articulate why each bullet that you fire is necessary. You have to articulate why each strike, each punch was necessary. What was it about that person after you've already shot them 16 times that you feel like you are still scared and need to shoot them 16 more? It makes no sense.
It doesn't make any sense. And you've been very outspoken, and thank you for that, for all your outspokenness concerning Sandra Bland, Eric Garner. I heard you a number of times in your podcast go off about, I think you called them the mouth. Pat Lynch. He is certainly an outspoken character. I mean, you know, he's... tell us what you really think about him and Officer Pantaleo and this crazy nonsense that's been going on.
Well, you know, the Patrolman Benevolent Association there in New York is the lobbying arm of the police department. It's not a union per se. And so they do what Pat Lynch does, what he's there to do, much like, you know, police departments, the system does what it's there to do. And so, listen, Pat Lynch has never seen a use of force, a deadly use of force that he can't get excited about. And I find it offensive that he would say to his officers, don't do your job. They should be recruiting there in New York for people who actually want to work and want to do the job. You have an officer who used a prohibited chokehold, Daniel Pantaleo. We saw him choke Eric Garner to death. And later he sits behind a desk, reportedly earning $93,000 a year, while they try to outweigh the statute on civil rights investigations, on any real substantive disciplinary action for him. But for that civilian review board deciding to get involved and take a look at this, I believe Daniel Pantaleo would have kept his job. Because listen, Commissioner James O'Neill didn't just find out in August that he lied. And when Commissioner James O'Neill said during that press conference, if you listen to his words very carefully, and you'll hear the doublespeak, the code talk that I referenced, when he says, he's talking to his officers, and he says, hey, if I was Daniel Pantaleo, I might have done the same thing. But he wasn't honest to internal affairs investigators, and so now he's ineffective. Well, Daniel Pantaleo wasn't ineffective and could no longer be a New York police officer because of a chokehold. He was ineffective because he lied. And but for that civilian review board, civilians getting that information in their hands, civilians who the commissioner couldn't pull into a room and have a fireside chat with about why we're not going to do anything about this lie, but for that, he would still be on the job. Because listen, he wasn't the only one that was there. Otherwise, Sergeant Kizzy Adonis would be ineffective. She was the supervisor who was there, who was charged with failure to supervise when she didn't take control of that use of force situation. She wasn't deemed ineffective. As a matter of fact, Sergeant Kizzy Adonis was just recently disciplined as well. They allowed her to plead guilty 5 years later, plead guilty to the charge of failure to supervise, and her only penalty was to relinquish 20 vacation days. So when this commissioner pretends as if he's wanting to do the right thing and is offended by, you know, the officer's actions and his hands were tied, he's being intellectually dishonest.
So all of this obviously creates this gap, this divide between the public and the police. How do we fix this? I mean, obviously the police aren't going to stop. People like Pat Lynch, who have sympathies like Pat Lynch, aren't going to stop. Commissioners, mayors are going to stall. How do we stop all this? Is it even possible? Are we just wasting our time spinning our wheels?
Well, listen, it's not going to happen in my lifetime for sure. But there's several things that we can do and several things that we need to do. And one of them is we need to get engaged in the community. We need to attend town hall meetings and meetings that are dealing with reelecting or selecting new police chiefs and sheriffs and police commissioners. We need to vote because every police chief serves at the pleasure of a mayor. And we need to make sure that we have the right people in positions, prosecutors, district attorneys, commissioners, sheriffs, mayors. All of these people should be beholden to the community. And then the other thing that we need to do is we need to get on these police departments, because change is going to come from within. I say this all the time, and activists go crazy when I say get on the job. But listen, we know that we've heard from an FBI report that KKK are infiltrating police departments. And so if infiltration is a word you want to use, or just getting on is a word you want to use, Black and brown folks, but Black people in particularly, need to join these police departments. I believe patrol officers are the backbone of any police department. And my position was, I had more effect, influence as a patrol officer, being a training officer, because I'm running my car. You're my young recruit. I'm going to make sure that you treat people, interact with people, deal with people in a way that's dignified, respectful, and professional. And I was able to do that as a patrol supervisor as well with my subordinates. I had a den of officers that worked for me. And so when Sergeant Dorsey rolls up, we're not sitting people on the curb. We're not talking to people crazy. We're not doing those things that you would do if I weren't there to make sure you aren't treating people who look like me appropriately. And then also, we need to be on juries when folks go to jail and when they're arrested and when officers manufacture probable cause and reasonable suspicion, and because great deference is given to an officer's version of events. We need to be on those juries so that we can have some say in terms of how these things are ultimately adjudicated. I know I've certainly been guilty of dodging subpoenas.
You think you could get on a jury?
Well, I don't know. I don't know if they would even pick me, but right. I know if I don't apply, I know if I don't show up, right, I won't get picked.
That's true. Right? That's true.
And so it's not a one thing. It's a multifaceted, multi-pronged approach, and we got to do all of that. We can't teach our kids FTP. That's what they want us to do.
Right.
While they're steadily recruiting KKK and like-minded folks.
Right.
We need to be on that department because, listen, when you're working with somebody like me, you're not going to do those things that you would do when I'm not there, right? Because you understand. You know what it is. You get a partner. You guys think alike. You look alike. You walk alike. I finish your sentences. And so if we're cutting up together, then, you know, I want to work with you every day.
Right.
But on the days when you're not there, now I've got to work with Dorsey. And, you know, I don't know if I could trust her like that. So on this day, I'm not going to be doing that foolishness. It might sound like, you know, a small benefit, if you will, but I think that's how it starts.
Right.
And then you put yourself in the feeder pool if you so desire, and you want to be a chief, or you want to be a captain, or you want to be a commander. You got to first get on the job. You got to be in the feeder pool, and you got to promote up.
I think that is so profound what you're saying. Before I left my department, I was actually part of the recruiting team. I had to go to different colleges and things like that, and I could not get Black people to be interested. I mean, we gave out a bunch of applications to a lot of females and obviously to a lot of white male. And the biggest issue I had is that a lot of brothers just weren't interested. A lot of sisters weren't either. And it was very, very frustrating to me. And as you're saying, if we don't get on the job, number one, we can't sit in the car and we can't have that influence in training younger officers and being seen by the public, which is obviously very important. That's number one. And then number two, we'll never become the chiefs and deputy chiefs. You'll never see higher command structures if we're never there in the first place.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And you know what? You know what's funny to me is that, not to cut you off, but you know, you see young Black men who get arrested and they go to prison and they spend years and years wrongfully convicted or whatever, and they get out and they go back to school, and what do? They want to be attorneys because they want to represent other young Black men who are railroaded. How come Black folks who get pulled over by the police driving while Black don't decide, you know what, let me get on this police department. Let me make a difference in this community. I don't understand the mindset.
That's profound what you're saying. It really, really is. I don't think that there's a long-term goal in mind with too many of our people. I had a conversation with my daughter, and she's talking to some kid. My daughter's 22, and she's talking to some kid who's 23. No, my daughter's 21. This kid's 23. And tried to get him to become a cop, and he's not thinking that along those lines either. And it's frustrating. My son is 23. His friends, I tried to get his friends to take the test, and they're just not interested. And they're not thinking long-term. They're not thinking about going to school. They're not thinking about that kind of stuff. And that's really frustrating to me, is along what you're saying.
And they're not recruiting us, right? They don't have a vested interest in us getting on these police departments. And so here in LA, my police chief is not out looking for folks that look like me to get on LAPD. LAPD is predominantly Hispanic now. And so I've accepted and acknowledged that black folks' time on the Los Angeles Police Department has come and gone because there just aren't enough of us in that theater pool that I'm talking about, and they're not going out to get us, to encourage us. I just went to a Black Men's Summit that was put on by a local radio station here, KJLH radio station. Stevie Wonder owns it, right? And he's been doing this for the last 3 years. And I said, because I was on the panel for police reform, and I said, wouldn't it be nice if our police chief really was honest and sincere about his proclamations for recruiting black folks? Wouldn't they have had a booth set up for this event to talk to, engage, encourage young black men that were attending this summit to get on LAPD? They didn't even have a booth set up. And so I could go on and on about opportunities and chances where they could recruit us, but they don't. Why? Because they don't want us there. And when we say FTP, they say, thank you.
And I don't want to cause a divide between the black and Hispanic community, or, you know, when people talk about black and brown, but listen, there is a little bit of a divide, and I sense it a lot. Well, not that I've lived there, but I heard a lot about LA, the southern states, Texas, and things like that. So, I mean, black people really have to kind of watch out for themselves at certain times.
Absolutely.
Your mentioning of the KKK and the FBI report 2006, I did that in a previous episode as well, that these people are actively going forth and getting on police departments, running for public office, and it's just terrible. And meanwhile, black folk, once again, are sitting on the sidelines, choosing to abstain from these public arenas. Ridiculous.
And listen, this is not anything new. I just, matter of fact, my podcast, Sergeant Dorsey Speaks, comes out every Tuesday, and on tomorrow, I will be speaking about a story that I read last week where a Michigan police officer, 20-year veteran police officer, just got fired because he had his house up for sale. Prospective buyers came, did a walkthrough, and what do they see? All through this man's home, KKK applications framed on the wall.
This man was idolizing flag. That stuff.
Yeah, I mean, he was a card carrying clerk, and he had been on the department for 20 years. And so now they're talking about, okay, he was involved in a deadly shooting in 2009. They're thinking we may need to take a look at this because, of course, great deference was given to what he said. And what he said in 2009 is that this gentleman had hit him in the head, and that was why this officer, whose name is Anderson, wound up shooting and killing this man. And so we don't even know if that's true now. This is a guy who's been on the job for 20 years. 20 years with that mindset. How many black folks did he put through the system falsely? How many black men are serving time now? How many cases? Could you imagine if the prosecutor just went through their log and looked at every arrest, every conviction that had this officer's name attached to it? Do you know how many cases potentially could be overturned, thrown out? I mean, I don't know if they're going to put that kind of energy into this one officer, because listen, if people don't know what I just said, they won't even be asking for it. But I say all the time, anytime there's word of an officer who has done something outrageous, egregious, unlawful, if anybody in that town has been written a ticket, had their car towed, arrested, whatever, you need to contact the district attorney and say, I need a do-over on this particular case, because now we know that this guy is either a liar, or he's a racist, or he's both.
Absolutely terrible. And I certainly hope that they do look into him, into his background and his career and everything that he's had his name attached to. That's certainly ridiculous. I do remember hearing about that story. It's absolutely ridiculous. I do follow you, your podcast, and I certainly hope that any of my listeners will subscribe to your podcast. So what is going on with the Amber Geiger case? I've been following you for that, because they don't seem to be reporting about that in Connecticut.
Well, you know, I'm waiting to see. I've got some folks on the ground there that are going to kind of keep me apprised. But, you know, I have my own thoughts about that whole Amber Geiger thing. And what I've been telling folks, you know, is prepare for an acquittal. I do not believe that they are going to find this little diminutive white woman guilty. I think because of what I say, great deference is given to what she says, even though it makes no sense. I think that it's going to be very difficult for a jury of her peers to find that she didn't enter the wrong apartment and that she wasn't frightened. The problem that I have with Amber Geigel is that, first of all, she worked at a police station two blocks from where she lived. And so they make a big deal from time to time in the media about her working a long shift, 12 hours or 14 hours. And, you know, that maybe she was confused when she got home. She drove 2 miles, first of all.
Right.
I mean, two blocks. She drove two blocks to get home. She was able to get there. I believe, and this is what I said, and so I'm going to say it for your audience, I believe that Amber Geigel was working as a security guard for that hotel complex. Now, I don't know about your department. I don't know if you've ever heard of this, but here in Los Angeles, police officers, it was not uncommon for you to be given, you know, a discount on your rent or something if you agree to be on-site security. So whenever there's, you know, a loud party or some kind of neighbor dispute, leasing office can call you and say, hey, could you go talk to the tenants over here? You do that, and they got security on scene.
That does happen in Connecticut.
I think that's exactly what she was doing. And also, the reason that I say that is because very early on, I heard a report, and I recorded it when I saw it on the internet because I figured it might disappear. But when Amber Geigel called 911 after the shooting, she was talking to the 911 dispatch, and the 911 dispatch was repeating her words. What dispatch said to the fire department and the paramedics that were responding to the shooting is, a security guard said, security officers on scene, that was Amber Geigel. I think in the excitement of all of that, she said exactly what she was doing. She was there because she worked security. She didn't take off her uniform. She wore her uniform from home, from work to home, because again, if a police officer shows up at your door in uniform, are you going to question, are you on duty or off duty?
Right.
Nobody's going to ask that question. You're going to assume that they're on duty.
Right.
So if she shows up at both of John's apartment in her uniform, he doesn't know whether she's on duty or off duty. My premise is she was off duty wearing her uniform to give the appearance of an on-duty police officer, but she was really hired security. And then the other thing, and I'll shut up, is how did she open his door? Because I think she had a master key, because I think she was security.
So you think that she opened the door and an argument ensued and she shot him?
That's what I think. I think she opened the door. They probably said something, and we won't know what they said because he's not here. She opened the door, something was said, and she shot him. And with the way you, the way I see her, and I'm just, you know, this is my sergeant, you know, spider tent senses, if you will.
Right.
You know, I'm watching her pacing back and forth, and you know, she was probably thinking, OMG, I have messed all the way up. What the hell? And now I got to come up with a story. You know, oh my God, what am I going to say? How am I on the fourth floor when I live on the third floor? My dogs, I got three or four. He has none. You know, this whole thing about the red carpet. Listen, and then they give her 3 days before she even turns herself in.
No, that's
offensive.
That is offensive.
It's offensive.
And the chief is a black chief, right? Black female chief is that right?
Don't get me started. Yes, a black female, because you know the other thing I say is all skin folk ain't kin folk.
Yeah.
And listen, she came from another agency, so I don't know. She came from Detroit, and I don't know if she came over there and didn't have a support system, and because she's an outsider, if you will, she bowed to the will of the city manager. Because listen, why would you allow another agency to investigate a homicide in your city? They would have had to take me away screaming, clawing, and hollering. And then they would have had to fire me on TV live before I would have relinquished that investigation over. I would never have given it to someone else.
Well, some agencies are trying to get away from that. Some states are trying to get away from that. In Connecticut, my agency, the Waterbury Police Department, if we shot someone, the state police would have to come in and do it. So that is becoming a trend, which I actually think is good, because it should, in theory, reduce the likelihood of cover-ups and things like that.
Well, unless you have an agency who takes over and allows her to get her bail money together and her
security
together, allows her to move out, break her lease.
Yeah, that when I heard you breaking all that down, I'm like, yeah, this is just nobody else would do that. I couldn't just go to my neighbor's house, do all that, and be allowed to move, break my lease, get my dog situated, come 3 days, and then surrender. I mean, that's just I'm really disappointed in that, how that whole thing went down. I'm also disappointed in that whole situation with the black female chief in Phoenix, Arizona, with the rogue cops there just yelling and screaming over the 99-cent doll. That whole debacle out there, just really disappointing.
Well, you know, that's why I say all skin folk ain't kin folk. And then let's slide on over to Florida with the black sheriff Gregory Tony. You know, over there in Florida, they had that white officer who beat this kid savagely outside of a fast food joint, and Sheriff Gregory Tony really didn't have a whole lot to say about that.
I mean,
I don't know why.
If we're going to get into these positions, then we have to do what's right. We have to do, and I'm saying about white officers, anyone, right? You have to do what's right. And particularly as African-Americans, I mean, if we're going to do this, there's no sense to climb up the ranks and you're going to be part of the problem. I mean, grow a pair and just do what you have to do. Listen, I truly appreciate you coming on the podcast. I'll give you a minute to promote what you got going on. I know you wrote a couple books, Black and Blue, The Creation of a Manifesto, The True Story of African-American Woman on LAPD, and The Powerful Secrets She Uncovered. That's volume one. I'm currently reading volume two, Black and Blue, The Creation of a Social Advocate. And on the podcast, I think you said you had another volume coming out.
Yeah, so I'll just say this for you and your readers. Volume one, The Creation of a Manifesto, is included in volume two. And the reason that I came out with volume two is because I wrote volume one in 2013 before all the spate of shootings and uses of force occurred. And to be honest with you, there was a lot of profanity in volume one because I was just writing it because I was venting and I needed to get some stuff off my chest. So last year I came out with a revised version. I cleaned it up a little bit in terms of the profanity. And then I talked about all of the things that happened from 2014 up until 2018. All of the uses of force, Betty Shelby, Terrence Crutcher, Tamir Rice, John Crawford, everything that's happened. For folks who may not know all the stories, I talk about some of the families of these victims of deadly police force that I have come to know, network with, collaborate with, if you will. And then more importantly, I talk about what you need to do, comply and complain. I have a workshop, a speaking tour that I do, because listen, I tell everybody, holding court curbside with a police officer will get you hurt. There are policies and procedures, and while you may not get the result that you want, you still need to follow those policies and procedures in terms of filing a complaint. Because absent that, you might wind up like Mike Brown or Eric Garner, or you name any other person who has been the victim of an errant police officer who's drunk with power, who will abuse you, who will kill you because you don't, quote, comply. And then the city will throw buckets of money at your family and you're gone. So Comply and Complain is my workshop. Anyone who's interested in what I do, what I say, you can visit my website, www.sgtcherildorsey.com. You can also subscribe, like, share, tell a friend about my podcast, Sergeant SGT Dorsey Speaks, and subscribe to my YouTube channel, Sergeant SGT Dorsey Speaks. Thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
Oh, no, thank you. And I want to ask one last question. So I'm reading the book, and Contempt of Cop. Did you really trademark that? I mean, it's got a TM next to it. Did you trademark that phrase, Contempt of Cop?
I did trademark the phrase, Contempt of Cop. Yeah, okay. And I'll just tell you real quick how that came to be, because my holding court curbside is, so I say, when you don't do what an officer says, there's a price to pay. You will be found guilty of contempt of cop. Piss me off, and I'm going to choke you to death. Piss me off, I might shoot you. Sandra Bland, put the cigarette out. You seem to be upset. Well, yes, I'm upset. You gave me a ticket after I pulled over to let you go by. What did he do? Brian and Sania, he got mad, contempt of cop. He took her to jail, and then we know what happened after that. So I just wanted to talk about that and have that accessible and available to just me. So yeah, I did.
Okay, all right. Well, listen, I think the first time I saw it was on the Young Turks. So you might want to give them a call Maybe they were just quoting you. I don't know, but whatever. So anyway, Sergeant Cheryl, I certainly appreciate you coming on the podcast. Thank you so much. Do you have any speaking engagements coming up for LEAP or anything like that?
I don't have anything right now. You know, from time to time, I'm on a lot of the local and international networks talking about police uses of force, deadly force. But of course, it's cyclical and it's breaking news when something happens and they want a fresh opinion and they want a real, candid, honest discussion, then I get calls. But I keep my engagements when there's something planned out in the future available and on my website. So if you want to know where I am or what I'm doing, SergeantDorseySpeaks.com or SergeantCherylDorsey.com. Either website will let you know where I am and what I'm doing.
And again, I certainly appreciate the candidacy that you bring to it. One interview I heard fairly recently, I think you were on the news and you were talking about the sheriff's department that was not going to respond to mental illness complaints.
Yes.
And then you said, I almost fell over, you said, well, I wish that they would not come to black folks or something like that.
Right, yeah. Right, I said to the police chief because, you know, he tried to justify that nonsense and say that, you know,
and that was crazy what he was saying. That was crazy.
Yeah, they were trying to keep their officers safe because they don't want them to come out and excite somebody and have them wind up getting into a use of force or where they wind up killing somebody who's mentally ill. So my thing was, well, shoot, can we use a little bit of that when you got somebody living while black or driving while black? Can you not come to those sir?
Yeah. So I appreciate your honesty. And it takes a lot of gumption to speak up and say those kind of things. So thank you. And keep on keeping on.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you.
All right. Thank you. Okay. We'll talk to you again. Thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Be good. Be safe.
Bye. Thank you so much to Sergeant Cheryl Dorsey, former sergeant with the LAPD, for coming on the show. She's truly a dynamic woman who's very outspoken in everything she's doing. She's been on CNN and Fox News, so I appreciate her coming on to Captain Hunter's podcast. Please make sure that you check out, subscribe, share, like her podcast, which is available on a number of platforms, iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, a number of different platforms. Please make sure that you subscribe to it, share it, like it, and all that. She will really keep you up to date on what's going on in the police world. Also, check out her YouTube channel. And I just wanted to end off with something that she said we can do as members of the community in order to force the changes that we want. She talked about going to town hall meetings. Make your voice known and heard. She said, get out there and vote. Police officers serve, and police chiefs in particular, serve at the will of the mayor. So if you don't like the way the administration of your city is going and you don't like the way that they conduct themselves with the police departments, we'll vote them out of office. Go to town hall meetings, vote them out of office. Get on the juries. Don't be afraid to sit on the juries. Too many times we try to get out of jury duty. But if you want change, and if you think that laws aren't going your way, then you have to get on the jury. You have to become part of the process, part of the solution, and not part of the problem. And finally, as a last thing, for you, all you young men and women, particularly those of color, but anyone, make sure that you're joining your police department. If you have what it takes, as I mentioned in another episode that I did, if you have what it takes, you have the integrity, number one, and the physical abilities, number two, and the mental capacities, number three. Those might not necessarily be in the exact order, but the mental capacity, the physical capacity, integrity, then join your local police department. And that would go for anything that you've see that there's a need to change. Make sure that you become part of the solution and not part of the problem. Well, that's it, ladies and gentlemen. Please don't forget to rate, subscribe, and share this episode. Please remember, ladies and gentlemen, to subscribe to the podcast, rate the episodes, and share it with your friends and even with your enemies. Make sure this information is getting out there. So that's it, ladies and gentlemen. Until next time, much love and peace. Take care.